The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Yunkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first article comes from the Harvard Heart Letter. It's entitled, Updated Advice for People with Heart Valve Disease. With expanded options for replacing stiff or leaky heart valves, more people can avoid surgery. The heart's four valves open and shut in a carefully timed sequence to move blood through and out of the heart to the body. But as people age, these one-way valves may narrow and stiffen, a problem known as stenosis, which partially limits blood flow. Heart valves can also leak, allowing blood to flow backward. That's called regurgitation. About 1 in 10 adults age 65 and older has moderate to severe heart valve disease. Without timely diagnosis and treatment, valve problems can worsen, causing serious and sometimes fatal consequences. The good news, more people who need a new heart valve can get one without major surgery. No one wants to have heart surgery, so people who need a valve replacement are very interested to find out if they qualify for a transcatheter valve implant, says Dr. Patrick O'Gara, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Most valve replacements are in people with stenosis of the aortic valve. In 2011, when the less invasive procedure, known as transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR, was first approved, it was limited to older people who were considered to be too ill for surgery. Today, many people age 65 and older who meet certain criteria can have TAVR, says Dr. O'Gara, who co-authored recently updated valve replacement guidelines in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. People younger than 65 are still advised to have surgical replacement because the longer-term consequences of TAVR haven't been studied much in that age group. Understandably, people prefer TAVR because it doesn't require general anesthesia and has an easier, shorter recovery. But TAVR isn't feasible or safe for people with certain anatomical issues, says Dr. O'Gara. For example, narrowed arteries outside the heart, peripheral artery disease, can make it difficult to thread the catheter up through the body to the heart. A buildup of calcium deposits in or below the valve also make TAVR riskier because the procedure can disrupt the surrounding tissues or dislodge flecks of calcium into the circulation, potentially triggering a stroke. And in some people, the valve delivered by TAVR may obstruct some of the arteries that feed the heart. Most people have aortic valves with three flaps, known as leaflets, but between 1 and 2% of people are born with bicuspid aortic valves, which have only two leaflets. This defect, which is 3 to 4 times more common in men than women, may run in families and leaves people more prone to aortic valve degeneration. They usually develop symptoms of aortic stenosis about 10 years earlier than people with a three-leaflet valve who develop age-related stenosis. The anatomy of a bicuspid valve can make TAVR more challenging, and many people with this defect also have an aneurysm, swelling due to weakened blood vessel wall in the aorta near the heart. As a result, most people with bicuspid valves needs surgery instead of TAVR. Most people with severe leakage of the aortic valve also require surgery. Mitral valve repair. About 1 to 2% of the population develop a condition known as mitral valve prolapse, which causes leaking or regurgitation. Most cases are mild, but some become severe and require surgical repair. Other people develop mitral regurgitation because of an enlarged left ventricle, which can occur after a heart attack or in response to long-standing atrial fibrillation or heart failure. The annulus, the fibrous ring of tissue supporting the leaflets, stretches out, preventing the leaflets from closing tightly. For most people with severe mitral regurgitation due to prolapse, surgical repair remains the standard treatment. The surgeon adds a new ring to shore up the annulus, but keeps the person's original valve. But for people with prolapse and severe leakage who are too weak or frail to undergo surgery, a transcatheter approach may be an option. Instead of delivering a new valve, the technique uses a device that pulls the edges of the leaflets together. The first of these devices, MitraClip, that's MitraClip, was initially approved only for people with prolapse, but was approved more recently for certain people with heart failure and mitral regurgitation. A similar device is expected to be approved within the year. The article goes on to explain that in a TAVR procedure, a valve made of cow or pig tissue is crimped onto the end of a thin, flexible tube called a catheter. The doctor threads the catheter from the top of the thigh up to the opening between the heart and the aorta. Once it reaches the diseased aortic valve, the new valve is deployed using a balloon or a self-expanding device, which then anchors to the old valve. The article also describes monitoring heart valve disease. Most heart valve problems are discovered when a physician hears an abnormal sound called a murmur while listening to the heart through a stethoscope. An ultrasound of the heart or echocardiogram can reveal any leaky or thick, stiffened valves. If you have a mild heart valve problem without any symptoms, you may simply need to monitor the condition with your doctor. Unfortunately, there are no drug therapies that can help prevent the progression of valve disease, but it's important for people to take any other heart drugs their doctor prescribes to prevent other complications that might worsen their valve problem. They should also stay alert for symptoms of the two most common valve problems. What are the symptoms of aortic stenosis? Well, they're shortness of breath, chest pain or tightness with activity, dizziness, and lightheadedness. What are the symptoms of mitral regurgitation? They are shortness of breath after activity or when lying down, fatigue, a rapidly fluttering heartbeat, and swollen ankles or feet. The next section is Ask the Doctor with Dr. Deepak L. Bhatt, Editor-in-Chief. The first question is, which blood pressure number matters the most? Question. My doctor told me I should get a home monitor to keep tabs of my blood pressure. Which number is most important in the reading, the top or the bottom one? This question comes up often, perhaps because doctors and patients alike tend to pay more attention to the top first number known as the systolic pressure. It reflects the amount of pressure inside the arteries as the heart contracts. The bottom or second number, the diastolic pressure is always lower since it reflects the pressure inside the arteries during the resting phase between heartbeats. As it turns out, both systolic and diastolic blood pressure are important. Per the most recent guidelines, you have what's called elevated blood pressure if your systolic blood pressure is 120 to 129. Once your systolic reading reaches 130 or higher, or your diastolic reading is 80 or higher, you're considered to have high blood pressure or hypertension. Most people have what's known as essential or primary hypertension, which means it's not caused by a medical condition, medication, or substance. Primary hypertension can affect both systolic and diastolic pressure to a similar degree. But sometimes, especially in older people, it affects mainly the systolic pressure. This is called isolated systolic hypertension. Why does this happen? As you age, your arteries tend to become less elastic and less able to accommodate surges of blood. Blood flowing through your arteries at high pressure can damage the inner lining of these vessels, accelerating the buildup of cholesterol-laden plaque. This further stiffens and narrows the arteries, a condition known as atherosclerosis. Because the same volume of blood has to pass through a smaller area, the systolic pressure tends to rise, while the diastolic pressure remains the same or gradually falls over time. In some people with isolated systolic hypertension, the diastolic pressure reading may drop into the 50s or even the 40s. Most studies show a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, especially stroke, related to high systolic pressure as opposed to elevated diastolic pressure. But in 2019, an 8-year-long study involving more than 1.3 million adults found that while elevated systolic pressure had a greater effect on cardiac outcomes, high diastolic readings also affected a person's risk, regardless of the systolic reading. To ensure accurate readings when you're checking your blood pressure at home, sit comfortably with your back supported, your feet flat on the floor, and your arm resting on a table with your palm facing up. If needed, support your arm with a pillow so that your elbow is at the level of your heart. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter of April 2021 is entitled, What's for Dinner? If you need inspiration, here are some heart-friendly suggestions from Harvard cardiologists. Even if you enjoy cooking, chances are you find yourself wondering what to make for dinner once in a while, especially if you're trying to eat more healthfully. And maybe you or someone in your household avoids all animal products or follows a low-carb eating style. Perhaps you need an easy meal for a quick weeknight supper or something a little fancier for a special occasion. No matter what your family's preferences, there is a wealth of options when it comes to following a diet that promotes cardiovascular health. The two main guidelines include plenty of plant-based foods, especially fruits and vegetables, and mostly unprocessed or minimally processed foods. Five cardiologists who treat patients at Harvard-affiliated hospitals shared their favorite meals, along with some of the inspiration for their choices. The first is Dr. Thomas Gaziano. And he says, My Italian-American mother taught all five of her sons to cook. Our Catholic tradition of having fish on Friday nights lives on in my family. We often pan-sear Norwegian salmon with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and serve it with couscous and an arugula salad tossed with olive oil, Parmesan cheese shavings, and fresh lemon juice. But my all-time favorite is Cioppino, a seafood stew with a base made with olive oil, onion, garlic, fresh fennel, parsley, crushed tomatoes, white wine, and seafood stock. We add whatever is fresh at the fish market, but our version often includes clams, mussels, shrimp, scallops, crab meat, calamari, and a whitefish like cod or halibut. Next comes from Dr. Michelle O'Donohue, and she says, most people would call my diet vegan, but I think it's important to point out that a vegan diet isn't necessarily healthy, because a lot of junk food is technically vegan, meaning it contains no animal products. I make it a point to focus on including only healthy ingredients in my family's meals. One my family loves that's very simple to prepare is a Mexican burrito bowl. I start with a base of brown rice and quinoa and add black beans sprinkled with cumin, corn, chopped lettuce, and chopped tomatoes, and top it all off with guacamole and salsa. My family can't get enough of this dish, and it takes very little time to make. Dr. Randall Zussman says, for me, a typical dinner is a salad made with cucumber, tomatoes, garbanzo beans, topped with an oil and vinegar dressing, and a bowl of soup, either vegetable or tomato soup or fish chowder. Or I might have baked or grilled chicken, or fish with lemon juice, with a vegetable like spinach, broccoli, green beans, or cauliflower. Normally, I have fresh fruit for dessert, but I enjoy ice cream on special occasions. Although I encourage my patients to follow a low-salt, low-fat diet, I also tell them that they can eat whatever they want on their birthday. It's hard for even the most dedicated person to follow a highly restrictive diet without some hope for relief. Next comes Dr. Melissa Wood, and she says, I'm the mother of four very athletic young adults, and three of them are vegan. I'm not going to lie, it's not always easy to prepare delicious protein-packed meals while respecting their preferences when they're all home for the holidays or other special occasions. I have gravitated towards several favorites, including a delicious vegan lasagna that features spaghetti squash and a homemade tomato sauce full of fresh herbs. Another favorite is quinoa stuffed butternut squash with a garlic and shallot balsamic reduction glaze. Finally, Dr. Stephen Wiviot says, over the last several years, I have found that a diet that is similar to a paleo or whole 30 diet, that's WHOLE, then the number 30 diet, has worked very well for me. These diets emphasize lots of fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, and lean meats, and limit processed foods, carbs, and sugar. We always keep a lot of cut fresh fruits and vegetables on hand for easy and healthy snacking. In the summer, we love to grill lean steak or chicken breast with a simple marinade of olive oil, ginger, and garlic, accompanied by a grilled or steamed green vegetable, like Brussels sprouts, asparagus, or broccoli. Another favorite side dish is thinly sliced sweet potatoes prepared with olive oil, salt, and rosemary, grilled or baked in the oven. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter, April 2021, is entitled Depression and Heart Disease, a Double-Edged Sword. Lifestyle changes, along with other proven therapies, can help improve these often overlapping conditions. Everyone goes through periods of feeling gloomy, irritable, or listless at least once in a while, and these emotions are perfectly normal after a diagnosis of serious heart problems, like heart disease. But if those unpleasant feelings drag on for weeks and gradually erase your sense of well-being, you may have depression. Over a lifetime, 1 in 5 Americans is affected by depression. But the risk of depression in people who've had a heart attack is 3 times as high as the risk among the general population. A heart attack is a life-changing event, and it's very common to feel overwhelmed, depressed, and anxious afterward, says cardiologist Dr. Allison Kelly Hedgepeth, co-director of the women's program at Harvard-affiliated Lounge Institute. Making positive changes to your lifestyle can go a long way toward improving both your mood and your heart health. But antidepressants and therapy are important too. These treatments can help ease symptoms of depression, which can give people the motivation to make changes, she says. Recognizing the problem. Thanks to broader recognition of the brain-heart connection, more doctors are screening their patients for depression using a simple screening test. When I ask my patients these questions, it can be very humbling. Both men and women are willing to share their feelings and talk about their emotions, says Dr. Kelly Hedgepeth. If your cardiologist or primary care provider doesn't ask you about symptoms of depression, don't hesitate to volunteer that information. People with depression can find it hard to muster the energy to stick to healthy habits, including choosing and preparing healthy foods, exercising, and taking prescribed medications on a schedule. Depression often goes hand in hand with anxiety, and both conditions can boost stress hormone levels. Elevated levels of one of the main ones, cortisol, can raise blood pressure and blood sugar levels. Depression also appears to increase inflammation, a known contributor to the buildup of cholesterol-filled plaque. It also causes blood cell fragments, known as platelets, to become more sticky and likely to form clots in the bloodstream. All of these changes leave people more vulnerable to a heart attack. Fortunately, there are many treatment options for people with depression and heart disease. According to a 2020 review in the Journal of the American Heart Association, antidepressants known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, help ease depression in people with coronary artery disease. Sertraline, or Zoloft, has the best evidence to date. For some people, these drugs improve symptoms enough to enable other positive changes, and people don't necessarily need to stay on them for extended periods of time. Dr. Kelly Hedgepeth says, talk therapy, especially cognitive behavioral therapy, has also proved helpful. This therapy is designed to help people recognize and change ingrained negative thoughts or behaviors. 3 lifestyle changes can benefit both mental and cardiovascular health: regular exercise, high-quality sufficient sleep, and mind-body therapy that encourages relaxation, like meditation. I encourage exercise for all my patients, and it's very helpful for depression too, says Dr. Kelly Hedgepeth. Chronic sleep problems plague many people, especially those who are worrying about their health. For many people, isolation during COVID-19 pandemic has worsened underlying depression and stress, which can further exacerbate sleep issues. Dr. Kelly Hedgepeth notes, practices that may help include mindfulness meditation, which teaches you to pay attention to your thoughts, emotions, and bodily sensations, especially your breathing. It can be particularly helpful for people who wake up at 2 a.m. with a racing mind, she adds. The article also explains the answer to the question, do you have depression? And it says, answering yes to either or both of the following questions means you're very likely to have depression. 1. During the past month, have you often been bothered by feeling down, depressed, or hopeless? 2. During the past month, have you often had little interest or pleasure in doing things that you previously enjoyed? There are also some other symptoms of depression, and these usually occur most of the day, nearly every day. They include fatigue and lack of energy, reduced appetite or increased craving for food, difficulty sleeping, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, angry outbursts, irritability or frustration, and trouble concentrating and remembering things. In a subheading, the article emphasized cognitive behavioral therapy and other types of counseling can help people with depression. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed it too.